This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University. And in today's episode, we re-release an episode that aired originally on January 15th, 2022, in which we discuss Martin Luther King Jr.'s tax perjury trial in 1960 with Eddie Dyer, a professor emeritus from Coastal Carolina University, who published an article about the episode in 2003. We hope you will find this episode interesting as we celebrate once again the great achievements of Martin Luther King Jr.
I'm Eddie Dyer, and I'm a professor emeritus at Coastal Carolina University. I did a little bit of everything there. Finally, for the last 9 years, was executive vice president and chief operating officer. I even was the first coach of the women's golf team, primarily because we didn't have any money at that time to pay someone. But I did a lot of different things at Coastal Carolina as the place grew, and it was a fun place to be. I was there 39 years and started out as professor of political science. So that was my run professionally, and I'm now professor emeritus, which I tell people emeritus simply just means old. And I am retired in Myrtle Beach.
It's a good place to be retired.
Yeah. It's a nice place here. Getting full too, I'm on the South Carolina Higher Education Commission. Governor McMaster appointed me there, and I'm on the Coastal Educational Foundation, and do a little other volunteer work and try to stay busy. So that's what I do, and that's what I've done.
Hey, well, we appreciate you being on. So Eddie is the author of a very fascinating article entitled "A Triumph of Justice in Alabama: The 1960 Perjury Trial of Martin Luther King Jr." It is published in the Journal of African American History. So as far as I can tell, that article is the most serious piece of scholarship about this episode in Dr. King's life. An episode, this trial about tax perjury, that Martin Luther King himself called a turning point in my life. So in this article, Eddie tells a story about when Dr. King was trialed for perjury with regards to filing his Alabama tax return. There's a quote I wanted to start off with, and it is in Eddie's article, and he quotes Fred Gray, who was Dr. King's attorney, and he says, Mr. Gray says, "No one would have predicted that an all-white jury in Montgomery, Alabama, the cradle of the Confederacy, in May 1960, in the middle of all the sit-ins and all the racial tension that was going on, would exonerate Martin Luther King Jr. But it really happened." So today we're going to talk about what really happened. So Eddie, can you set the stage for us? What led up to this this tax trial of Martin Luther King Jr.?
Let me take just a second before I do that and just show you Fred Gray's book here. He autographed a copy to me. Fred's a very gracious individual, an attorney in Tuskegee, Alabama. He gave me a whole afternoon to sit and chat with him there at Tuskegee, and he's retired now. But very good fellow. He was Martin Luther King's attorney for this trial. He put together a team, actually, and he was Rosa Parks' attorney. Rosa Parks being a very familiar name to those familiar with civil rights in the United States. Rosa Parks, and that I'll segue over into that, I would trace this trial all the way back to Rosa Parks in 1955. She was arrested for not giving up her seat to a white patron on a Montgomery bus, and she actually was lawfully seated in what was termed the colored section there. But they asked her to move because they got more white people on the bus than they had seats. So she refused. She was arrested. That night, a group printed about tens of thousands of flyers to encourage a boycott of the buses because she had been arrested for that in Montgomery. That boycott was successful and led to the creation of the Montgomery Improvement Association to address civil rights issues in Montgomery and Alabama generally. And the MIA, Montgomery Improvement Association, hired this young 26-year-old pastor at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church named Martin Luther King Jr., whose father was pastor of probably the largest church, African-American church in Atlanta at the time. And he was hired to be their spokesperson and their direct their activities. As happens in a lot of organizations, there was a lot of internal turmoil and jealousies and whatnot. And one of the individuals involved in that, several of King's biographers and historians agree that he went to the authorities and alleged that there were tax improprieties for King's outside earnings for speaking. And between that individual and a governor, John Patterson, who had won office on a segregation, really racist platform, between the two of them, they were able to get the local prosecutor named William Thetford to indict Martin Luther King for tax evasion, which was later changed to perjury because tax evasion was not a felony. And they wanted to convict King of a felony. So they changed the indictment to perjury.
Why was it important that it was a felony?
It would be a longer sentence and take him out of action a lot longer, a longer prison sentence for perjury. Tax evasion would have been just a short sentence and pay a fine and pay the taxes back.
So it seemed pretty explicitly like the intent was actually like to take him out of action. This wasn't that they were concerned
about
taxes.
Well, it certainly was, sure.
And, pretty explicit.
It was. And in my conversation with John Patterson in the course of researching this.
So it's Governor John Patterson, right?
Governor John Patterson, he admitted it as much. They were trying to get rid of him. You know, they were almost successful. And had they been, it would be, you know, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, the civil rights movement sort of floundered there for a while, leaderless. And would have been, would have had they, he'd gone to prison for 10 years, which is what they were trying to do. It was a 10-year sentence for perjury. That was the plan, to get him out of action, so, get him indicted and tried and found guilty and out of action and in prison.
Is tax perjury something that happens anytime you, like, sign your name to a legal tax document? If you know there's fraudulent information, is that the idea?
Technically, it could be called perjury. Perjury is lying under oath. And signing a government document and saying that the above information is correct, you know, for my knowledge, it was interpreted that way. But I've never come across or heard about or read about any other person being tried for perjury for tax evasion or tax fraud. So they were reaching here. First time they had ever prosecuted anyone for this, and probably the last time. They prosecuted him. They indicted him on his 1956 and 1958 tax returns. First prosecution was on the 1956. They could have gone for a second trial and prosecuted him on the 58 returns as well, but they declined to do so because the prosecutor admitted that they didn't have a case.
So for the 1956 trial, there was this person, this kind of rival, or this person that was unhappy with Martin Luther King, who jointly with the governor started causing this problem. What evidence did the state actually had? What did the evidence did the state actually have?
They had the auditor from the State Tax Commission met with King in January of 60. And showed him where he was, you know, he had not paid taxes on, I think about $7,000 of income, something like that, which today would be about $60,000, $65,000, somewhere in there. King was getting $5,000 to $10,000 for speaking engagements in 2021 dollars. But anyway, he met with the auditor from the State Tax Commission, and the auditor pointed out to him all the places where he thought that he was underreported and hadn't paid the taxes on it. And King wrote him a check right there. Later on during the trial, that auditor really helped King's defense because he admitted that he told King that he didn't see any evidence of fraud. So,
when King met with the auditor in January,
right?
And the auditor said, you know, you need to pay more tax. King wrote the tax, and during that time, the auditor said to Martin, "I'm doing this because I've been told to, or something, or there's no fraud, or what happened."
He didn't say that. That's why he was doing it, but he said, I don't see any fraud here. So, after that, the solicitor or prosecutor, district attorney there, I guess the governor was keeping tabs on what was happening here and told Thetford, the prosecutor, to seek an indictment. Thetford's son, I was able to communicate with. Thetford had died. And by the way, had all 12 jurors I tried to contact died between 1960 and 2001 when I was doing the research on this as well. But Thetford's son said he really didn't want to do this prosecution. And Governor Patterson admitted that as well when I talked to him when I was doing the research.
So how often would a prosecutor not want to prosecute, but then like someone above them tells them to? Is that common?
I don't think it's that common. Most states have locally elected district attorneys. They report technically to the state attorney general. The state attorney general can, I suppose, lobby with them and ask them to prosecute someone or get them indicted. But I've never heard of that happening here in South Carolina. Doubt it happens very often. Local prosecutors are locally elected and report to the people who elected them in their district. So I don't think it happens that often.
So there was this, so I asked what evidence there was there. So the King met with the auditor. The auditor got a check from King, told King he didn't think there was any fraud. Then what happened? I mean, how did things proceed? Was there any other evidence? Was there any other data that they had?
No. King thought it was over and was surprised when he was indicted. And the guy that from his organization that had gone to the authorities, his name was on the list of witnesses that the grand jury called to give testimony before they indicted King.
So they indict King, then what happens?
Well, once he's indicted, he posts bond and gets ready for trial. So
there's somewhere he gets arrested. Sorry.
Yeah. He gets arrested and post bond and gets ready for trial. Goes to Fred Gray, who had successfully. Well, actually, he did not successfully represent Rosa Parks. Fred sort of laughingly told me, he said, "It's odd when your whole reputation initially is based on a case that you lost." So, Rosa Parks was found guilty, was sentenced to jail. But anyway, Fred had some notoriety. He was a very good attorney, won a lot of civil rights cases, even went to the Supreme Court a couple times and won arguments there. King went to Fred Gray. Fred Gray put together a team from all over the country, really. He got a guy from Chicago, whose name was Robert Ming, who was a tax attorney. But Fred intentionally made the whole team African-American. And his key witness was an African-American CPA from Atlanta. So he told me he intentionally did that. He wanted to just show that could be done. So Bob Ming came. And a couple of other nationally known African-American attorneys. And it was quite an all-star team that he put together. So they didn't have long to, King was met with the auditor in January and went to trial in May. So, you know, they didn't have long to get their case together.
And how did King have the funds to pay for an all-star team like that? Was that like he just had enough money or he was able to raise it, or what happened there?
Well, he personally did not have enough money, but they undertook fundraising and ran an ad actually in the New York Times, a group of individuals in New York City, that led to a landmark a Supreme Court case, New York Times versus Sullivan, which expanded the protection for libel for newspapers and the media. So they ran an ad asking for money to help Martin Luther King in Alabama. They made a few factual errors in the ad, and the local police commissioner in Montgomery named Sullivan sued the New York Times, which I think had a distributor. They had like 40 papers in all of Alabama, but he sued them, I guess, for having the ad, and got a $500,000 judgment, which in today's terms is $4 or $5 million. The Times appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court and won the case. And after that, if you were a public figure or a public official, you had to prove malice before you could collect a judgment for libel. But anyway, there were several fundraising campaigns going on for King and for his legal defense. I came across a copy of a letter Jackie Robinson had written to King, urging him to be more careful with who he's letting raise money for him, because there were allegations of fraud internally in the organization. The NAACP was not happy with the way fundraising was being done, and so there were some internal issues about the fundraising. But they raised enough money to pay these attorneys, and there was also allegations that the attorneys were charging too much. From, I think the NAACP may have been that made that allegation. But anyway, Jackie Robinson at that time had retired from baseball in 1960, by the way, and was working for a candy company called Chock Full of Nuts. And he wrote the letter to Martin Luther King on that letterhead, and that was a candy. I guess it's still around. I think it is that. Do you know if it's still around?
I heard of it.
Chock Full of Nuts.
We'll have to check that out. Anyone who can find that should send it to us, and we can send out a few lucky listeners like a bag of candy or something.
Chock Full of
Nuts.
Yeah,
that'd be good. But the fundraising was successful, and they raised enough money to get the attorneys paid. And there were five of them, I think, on the team. Two of them were Alabama, one New York, one I think Illinois. I know Bob Ming was from Illinois. Bob Ming was a highly respected, highly successful tax attorney. The irony of his life was about 10 years after he won this case for Martin Luther King, he went to prison for tax evasion.
Oh, really?
Yes, odd. And he had a stroke while he was in prison and never recovered. So that was really odd that Mr. Ming had that sort of issue.
Okay, so he has an all-star team, and they go to trial, and how does it go?
Before the trial, what kind of pretrial motions were there? I found some of these pretty fascinating.
Yeah, the first was they were not happy with the jury panel composition. There weren't many African-Americans. There were only 3 out of 38 on the jury list, 3 African-Americans, and that the prosecutors immediately used their strikes to get rid of them. But the complaint was that's a very small percentage. I mean, there are certainly a lot more people in Montgomery, Alabama, who are African-American than that and who are on the jury, who are on the voter registration list. But as it turned out, they lost that. Another thing they challenged was the authority of the clerk to appoint a special judge, which they had to, because when they challenged the jury list, they subpoenaed the judge who was going to hear the case because he was on the local jury commission, selection commission. So they got rid of that judge and got another one in that evidently ran a very fair trial. They complimented him, King's legal team complimented him after the trial that he ran a fair trial. But the clerk, they questioned the authority of the clerk to appoint a special judge because they questioned his election because not enough African-Americans were allowed to vote. Another thing they moved for was a change of venue to move it out of Montgomery, where there was a lot of vitriol and a lot going on with the Montgomery Improvement Association and all of that. So, they also questioned the segregated seating in the court. The middle aisle was used in those days in Alabama to separate people attending the trial racially. And oddly enough, it was not de jure. It was probably de facto. It's just the way things shook out. I had to go down to Georgetown. I was appointed to defend somebody down in Georgetown when I was first here in 1976, 77, because they didn't have public defenders at that time. And the seating there was the same way, Georgetown, South Carolina in 1977. But here again, I think it was not written down anywhere that courtroom would be segregated, but that's just the way it shook out, I suppose. But those were the major pretrial motions that they made. There were 38 jurors on the list. Five were struck for reasons that I don't know about. The state used seven strikes. Three of them were to get rid of the African-Americans, and the other four were just, I suppose, for cause. The defense struck 21, so they were left with 12 individuals on the jury. So,
And they were 12 white males.
12 white males, correct. Yep. That was, in fact, there was everybody on the, as I recall, there were no females even on the jury panel list, the 38 that they started with. So I don't know why that was. I don't know how they pulled them out. They used to. I don't know if they still do. I haven't been to court in a while, but they used to have a tub full of numbers, and they would have an actually legally blind person come up and pick the numbers out that corresponded to names, and that's the way they picked the jury panel. So I don't know how Alabama did it in those days. And that was one of the problems. The stenographers in those days were private. They didn't have a court stenographer. They hired people by trial. And if there was no appeal where you didn't need the transcript, they just threw it away. They didn't keep the trial transcripts. Don't have a transcript of the trial. Huh. Or any trial from that era in Alabama, and probably other states too did it the same way.
So what do we know, I mean, based on not having the transcript, what do we know actually happened in the trial? What were the main arguments on both sides?
Well, the main argument for the prosecution was that he had turned in false numbers. And they called a couple of bank officials. They had 999, I don't know how they arrived at that number, but they had 999 exhibits that they put up from the bank, deposit slips and all that. And so they called two bank officials, their first witnesses, to verify that these records that the auditor discovered were correct. And then they called the auditor himself. And that's pretty much all that the only witnesses they put up. But here again, the trial, I think, was over, probably in the minds of the jurors, when the state auditor admitted that he had told, Ming asked him, well, didn't you tell Dr. King that you didn't see any fraud here? And he said, yes, I did. I told him that, and I didn't see any fraud there. So, you know, for a conviction to stand, for an indictment, the Latin words are actus reus and mens rea. Actus reus means you have to commit an act that violates the law. Mens rea means you have to have a guilty mind or the intent to have done that. So there was the state auditor pretty much admitted that King had no intent, no fraud, no intent to do this. So
it seems like it's going to be pretty hard to get a charge on perjury to stand if the auditor himself admits there was no fraud to begin with.
Yeah, they're key witness. Their only witness says he didn't see any fraud. And I was surprised, and I didn't find any record of it. I was having to use the newspapers, basically. I didn't see where the defense had made a motion for not guilty verdict from the judge and just stop the trial right there. They continued on. The defense put up several witnesses. King's secretaries. He had two secretaries who talked about how he would go out and make a speech and come back and Either they would take the check to the bank or he would. But their best witnesses was a CPA that Fred Gray had found in Atlanta, and was actually very convincing and impressed the jury as well.
Was King a good record keeper?
You know, there are two versions of that. His wife is quoted as saying that Martin was not all that. All he was interested in was going out and spreading the word, getting the money to the movement, didn't use any of it personally, but she said he was not a very good record keeper. On the other hand, Blayton, the fellow from Atlanta, the CPA from Atlanta, said that when he went over King's records, they were excellent. He said they were very precise and that he had kept. I think truth is probably somewhere in the middle there. King probably had other things to do, and he really, I mean, you know, CPAs and guys who teach accounting are left-brained. I mean, they work with numbers. King was a pretty creative guy, I think. More right-brained than left-brained. Wasn't concerned about numbers. I mean, if the money was there to help the movement and pay the rent, that's probably what he, you know, he was a minister. He wasn't a CPA or an accountant.
Yeah.
So I think truth probably is somewhere in the middle, but there was no indication that he was being fraudulent in this, and no indication he was spending the money on himself.
So what happened? I mean, they had this person say there was no fraud.
Right.
They had so you said there were several witnesses from the defense. What other witnesses were there for the defense other than the CPA?
His secretaries testified.
And the King CPA himself testify?
Dr. King testified. Yep, they really struggled. The team, Fred Gray said they struggled, argued internally, and really had a hard time. But they wound up putting him on the stand, and he spoke well for himself.
So everybody's testified. What I mean, how long did the jury think about it, or what happens after everybody testified?
About 3 hours.
And we don't know.
I came back with a not guilty verdict. And I, from King's statements in his biographies, in his autobiography, he was stunned. And the newspaper account said he sat there stunned and didn't move for a while. And the attorneys were very emotional, and as was his wife. And they thanked the judge. And then the judge told people he had people go out by row in an orderly fashion.
Now, the name of your article is A Triumph of Justice. And I think that term Triumph of Justice comes actually from a quote from Coretta Scott King.
Correct. Yep.
Which I think is kind of indicative of how they felt about this. That surprised or not, after it was done, they thought, like, this was just amazing that the right thing actually happened for once in a time
yes.
period in which they weren't necessarily used to that happening.
Yes, reaffirmed her, she said it reaffirmed her belief in the dignity, or I forget how she phrased it, the goodness of men. And Dr. King said that it was a turning point in his life, that coming through that trial, he preached the next day, the trial ended on a Saturday, and the jury verdict was rendered on a Saturday. He preached the next day, and one of those present said that he appeared very reflective and that he had aged a good bit, not physically, but in his philosophy and his emotions a good bit, that it was evident that this had affected him.
I think it's hard to understate how important this was. I mean, he was not guilty, so it's as if we can forget about it, but it really would have been a big deal had he been guilty. This really could have changed quite a lot. And I think to see that and to go from there's this possibility that I'll be in prison for the next 10 years to I'm innocent, I can preach the next day, it's a big deal, not just for King personally, but for all of like civil rights history and American history.
Very much so. Very much so. And that's what surprised me about this trial, nobody had written about it. The more I looked into it, when I first read about it in the newspaper, this day in history thing down in the corner of newspapers, Cincinnati Inquirer, I happened to be up there, and I thought it was a misprint. said an all-white jury in 1960 in Montgomery, Alabama, found Martin Luther King Jr. not guilty of perjury and tax evasion. And I thought, well, when I get back to Coastal Carolina, I'm going to look into this. The more I look into it, two things. It surprised me. Secondly, it surprised me that there was not more written about it. It was. It speaks, I think it speaks well for rule of law, not only in Alabama, but if you can get this sort of fair trial in 1960 in Alabama with the racial issues involved, I think it speaks well for the rule of law. It speaks well for those 12 men. I'm surprised more hadn't been written about it. Hopefully somebody will. The one thing that I was unable to do, I was unable to get into the archives of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Sam Yett, who was a fairly famous writer and civil rights person, was at the trial, and I was never able to connect with their archives. So,
well, it's a fascinating story, and it's an uplifting story in an era that often had many kind of deflating outcomes. And I'm really glad that we had the opportunity to talk to you and learn about this really interesting aspect of history.
I think Governor Patterson's last few words to me were, when I talked to him on the phone, he'd gotten old. He served on the Alabama Supreme Court of Criminal Appeals for a while after he was governor. The Alabama had at that time, and may still, I don't know, they had a Supreme Court for civil appeals and a Supreme Court for criminal. But he said this in summation. He said, we were wrong, and King fought the thing, and you have to hand it to him. So I think that probably speaks for King's career. I mean, many things were wrong. He fought those things and paid the ultimate price. And if you look at his speeches leading up to his assassination, he knew he was going to pay the ultimate price, but it didn't deter him. And I think that's part of his greatness, is that he stayed there where he needed to be for the time that he could stay there.
Yeah, and I think we all and our society is better off because of his efforts. I think that goes without question.
Very much so, yes.
Jeff, any last questions?
I do not. I really appreciate this time to talk about two amazing things.
Eddie, thanks so much for joining us, and really appreciate your insights. And it's been fun to learn from you as we think about Martin Luther King around his birthday. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it, and hope your two institutions continue to prosper.
All right. Thank you very much. This has been another edition of Tax Chats. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.